You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko otou toku ingoa. Nau mai, hare mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. E whai aki nei coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the party's support for the five unions taking the government to court over their pay equity law changes, the final cost of the IREX ferry project's cancellation, and the Resource Management, Consenting and Other System Changes Amendment Bill passing in Parliament. And I spoke to Stefan Hoadley, a retired professor in politics and international relations at the University of Auckland, to discuss the outcomes of the Trump-Putin summit that happened over the weekend. Max, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Gordon Nanau from the University of Auckland to talk about the ongoing situation between the autonomous region of Bougainville and Papua New Guinea. And I speak to Dr. Yi-Ting Chuang from the University of Auckland to discuss why people in Auckland and Hamilton aren't walking as much as they should.
He aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātū I mai, text in on 5395, or waia mai rānei, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware, e āhe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero anō, hi pakeheri roki roki marunga I te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi pōho me, haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Just yesterday, the Greens announced their support for five unions filing a legal case against the government in the High Court over their changes to pay equity laws. The nurses' organization, Tertiary Education Union, NZEI Te Reo Roa, Post-Primary Teachers Association and Public Service Association argued that the new rules breached the Bill of Rights Act and that the case gives workers who had been denied the right to challenge the changes a chance to challenge the government in court. In that same week, it was revealed that the total cost of the scrapped IREX ferry project had escalated to $657 million, following a final $144 million payment to previous contractor Hyundai. The project was originally scrapped in December 2023 after the total budget amounted to nearly $3 billion. And the Resource Management, Consenting and Other System Changes Amendment Bill recently passed in Parliament. Some of the changes included requiring councils to grant consents for energy infrastructure and removing a range of freshwater planning requirements from farmers. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March to get the party's take on all of these issues. So to begin, can you tell us about why the Greens are standing behind the five unions leading the legal case against the government in the High Court over the changes to pay equity laws?
Well, first of all, because we support women being paid what they're worth, and pay equity would have allowed some of our lowest paid women to be paid fairly. Part of the unions using this tool is the broader fight to not give up on these changes to pay equity. And so all power to the unions who are basically now using the courts as a way to challenge this decision, because as they have said, it risks undermining basic rights. And so we hope to see them having a successful result. But at the same time, we also want to make it clear that a Green Party-led government will restore pay equity settlements and allow women to be paid what they're worth.
The unions leading this case represent workers from a number of different industries. What does their collective action tell us about the scale of concern about the government's changes to pay equity laws?
Well, it shows that pay equity affects hundreds of thousands of people across the country. And it's great to see unions across a huge range of sectors collaborating to take this challenge via the courts to the government. I think that the messages from unions across the board has been clear. This change was not needed. It was unfair, and it would lead many of our women workers being paid low wages and struggling to make ends meet.
A spokesperson for the Office of Workplace Relations and Safety Minister Brooke Van Velden said that the government took the Bill of Rights Act into account when making changes to the pay equity laws and found that their changes were consistent with the bill. How would you respond to that?
Well, I guess she'll see whether the courts agree with her or not. But what we do know is that Brooke Van Velden also rushed through this piece of legislation with no consultation from people affected by it. And it was a rushed way to try to balance the budget. We know that the budget was balanced off the backs of our lowest paid working woman. And so, yeah, Brooke Van Velden claimed that it complies with the Bill of Rights. And now we're going to have to see whether that's the case in the courts.
And should the ruling of this case go against the unions, what would the Greens do next to maintain pressure on the government?
We've kept the scrutiny in Parliament on this issue, but we've also committed that should we change the government, that restoring pay equity will be one of our priorities in any coalition agreement.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Recently, it was revealed that the total cost of the scrapped IREX ferry project had escalated to $657 million. Following a final $144 million payment to the previous contractor, Hyundai. So my next question is, what was the Green Party's reaction to the total cost of the scrapped IREX ferry project?
Well, it shows that the government made a mistake here, and we could have used those hundreds of millions of dollars for infrastructure projects to better feed our kids. And now the people are worse off as a result of short-term thinking by the government. And at the same time, we are losing the one ferry that could have allowed us to transport goods in a rail-enabled way, which means we now have more trucks on our roads that end up costing us more money because of the damage they create to our roads as a result of this decision.
Winston Peters said that the cancellation was necessary to save taxpayers from the almost $3 billion in costs that the project would have amounted to. Do the Greens still think that the cancellation of this project was wasteful?
Yeah, we do think it was wasteful, and also would have enabled us, if we had continued with the project, we would have had rail-enabled ferries by next year. And so this is why we think that the government made a mistake here. We wasted hundreds of millions of dollars and now have even more delays down the line. And right now what we need is a government that is investing in critical infrastructure, which is not happening. Instead, we have just more and more kilometers of roads when we could have better quality ferries, better quality rail infrastructure, and things that government isn't prioritizing.
Finance Minister Nicola Willis also attributed the costs of the project to the previous Labour government, claiming that they mismanaged the Crown books. How would you respond to that?
I think most people are a bit over the blame game between Labour and National when it comes to these short-term thinking decisions. For example, while National may be able to blame the government for the state of the books, they have now borrowed billions of dollars effectively in order to pay for the tax cuts. And so it just shows that the government isn't serious about actually long-term thinking and good long-term infrastructure decisions. And what we've seen with the ferries is a prime example of that. Short-term thinking that has now cost us hundreds of millions of dollars that we could have used for other types of infrastructure.
And going forward, how would a Greens-led government manage cross-strait travel in a way that's sustainable and cost-effective?
One of the things that we can do is to continue to invest in rail-enabled ferries as well as rail infrastructure. At the end of the day, if we look at the whole of our transport sector, what we need to invest is in things that are allowed to travel in rail that actually costs us less down the line, and it's more environmentally friendly and has less of an environmental impact than relying on trucks to transport our goods, services, and people.
All right, moving on to the last topic. A few days ago, the Resource Management Consenting and Other System Changes Amendment Bill passed in Parliament. Part of the government's plan to fully replace the RMA, some of the changes in this amendment bill include requiring councils to grant consents for certain energy infrastructure within a year, removing a range of freshwater planning requirements from farmers, and allowing discharges into waterways as long as councils were confident that their planning would improve the waterway within a decade. So next, I'd like to ask, what was the Green Party's reaction to this bill getting passed?
This whole bill is an affront to our environment. This bill is effectively giving companies and agribusinesses permission to pollute. And at a time where our fresh waterways are in crisis, it's honestly a smack in the face for our natural environment and actually the communities that depend on clean, fresh water to allow our waterways to continue getting more polluted while the government does not have a credible plan to clean up our waterways.
This bill streamlines approvals for infrastructure and energy projects. Could this have a positive impact on renewable energy generation?
Yeah, but this is kind of a problem with what the government is doing. They are creating a few good things here and there on a piece of legislation while also tagging along a bunch of removals of environmental protections. We cannot be sorting out pollution by just putting in a few more solar panels. We need a comprehensive plan to deal with pollution, as well as a serious investment in renewables, which this government isn't doing, as they are more prioritizing things like coal instead of actually putting energy into renewables.
Additionally, what impacts will this bill have on councils and their decision-making process?
We're concerned that this government, despite its so-called commitments to localism, is not actually committing to councils being empowered to make adequate decisions when it comes to their own well-being infrastructure, and that they're not resourced to ensure that resources are there so that councils can build the infrastructure we need. And so we are concerned that the most recent bill moves in that direction of taking away the ability for councils to genuinely have the power to solve the issues of today. And we're seeing that as well by making it harder for councils to fix big issues such as clean water, which councils are grappling with.
And once again, this bill is being introduced as an interim step until the government's fully planned replacement of the RMA. What steps will the Greens take in response to that?
What we're going to be fighting is an overhaul of the RMA that does put environmental protection and long-term planning at its core. So for us, it's about having a resource management act that actually protects nature, ensures that we can have good quality housing, and we can also protect our urban natural environment. Things that this government isn't prioritizing, so the Greens will continue fighting so that we have a resource consent piece of legislation that allows our communities to be well as opposed to our environment being completely degraded.
And that was Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez March talking to us about the party's support for the five unions taking the government to High Court over their pay equity law changes, the final cost of the IREX ferry project's cancellation, and the resource management consenting and other system changes amendment bill that passed in Parliament recently.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
I don't kiss men.
The Wire.
But I kissed him.
Over the weekend, the highly discussed summit between US President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin was held in Anchorage, Alaska, to discuss the terms for an end to the war in Ukraine. The summit, which lasted for a total of less than 3 hours, resulted in no ceasefire terms or any formal deals being achieved. Putin's conditions for an end to the war remained unchanged, with Trump walking away from the summit, ruling out Ukraine's NATO membership or reacquisition of Crimea. Ukraine, who were excluded from the summit, criticized its direction, with many critics describing it as an optics victory for Vladimir Putin. I spoke with Stefan Hoadley, a retired professor in international relations and politics at the University of Auckland, to discuss the Trump-Putin summit, as well as the hypothetical upcoming summit between Putin and Zelensky that Trump had also proposed. What was your reaction to the recent Trump-Putin summit that happened over the weekend?
The summit itself was a spectacle of United States hubris, with B-2 bombers flying overhead and F-35 fighters in the background, the red carpet. It turned out to be a lot of theater, and although we're happy to see the two protagonists getting along, we hope that that has some impact on the real world of combat and rivalry. But in the end of the day, we found that no progress was made whatsoever. Trump had retreated from the idea of a ceasefire, tried to redefine the terms of the discussion. The press conference was canceled, the lunch was canceled, and the whole thing began to look like a bit of performance by Trump, again, to put him in the center stage and in the world spotlight, which he was. So he did achieve that end. Probably every country in the world ran television shorts of him and Putin meeting. And so he is by far the most famous, the most recognizable figure on the planet, maybe of the whole century. But was anything accomplished in terms of the war? No.
Some critics have described the meeting as an optical win for Putin. Is this something that you would agree with?
Yes, I would. Putin was, as many commentators said, was brought in from the cold. That is, he was a pariah. He was an international criminal court indicted person for war crimes. He would be arrested, theoretically arrested, if he stepped into any of 120 different countries, not the United States, because the United States does not recognize the authority of the International Criminal Court, neither does Russia. So the choice of Alaska was perfect, not only because Putin could avoid the risk of arrest, but also because Putin could show that he was a world leader equal in stature to Trump, and also allow the Russian hyper-nationalists back home to toy with the idea of getting Alaska back again under Russian control. So it was an absolute triumph for Putin.
Following the meeting, Trump made a post on his Truth Social account, placing the onus of achieving a peace deal on Zelensky, and also saying that NATO membership and reacquiring Crimea would be off the table for Ukraine. On top of the fact that the Trump administration isn't pushing for further sanctions on Russia, what do you think that this signals to Ukraine and the international community regarding the Trump administration's alignment in this conflict?
Certainly, it seems like Trump is playing the role of a bully. He is exercising American power, not responsibly, not in consultation, not in coordination, not for the common good, but for his personal good and his personal acclaim. Putting the onus and the blame on Ukraine is like blaming the victim for a crime. And it is quite clear to me that Trump also wants Ukraine to surrender portions of Donetsk and Luhansk in return for some temporary peace or at least ceasefire. And that is something Ukraine will not do. And I don't think the West wants Ukraine to do that, because Ukraine has a fairly well-defined defensive line built up where the current battle line has stabilized more or less. And that to move backwards is to abandon that fortifications and trench work and other kinds of barriers, and to make Ukraine more vulnerable than ever before to Russian breakout. So the Trump's whole approach to the Ukrainian conflict seemed to me upside down. It's certainly contrary to the Europeans' view of it, certainly contrary to the Ukrainians' view of it. And government leaders, the ones that met with Trump, or just have to bite their tongues and hold back their disgust for the way Trump is playing this in order to flatter him, in order to avoid his angry reactions and maybe impulsive damage that he might cause to the peace process. So I'm entirely on Ukraine's side and the European side on this one, and I believe that Trump is causing damage to the process rather than moving it forward in a constructive way.
Moving forward, Trump announced plans to arrange a one-on-one meeting between Putin and Zelensky. What do you expect the outcomes of that meeting to be, should it happen?
Well, again, Putin hasn't budged one inch. He has been perfectly consistent in his goals for the last 3 years, and in fact, in many respects, since 2014, when the first Putin push into Ukraine, into Crimea, took place. Zelensky is very much dependent on the United States and Europe for weapons, for economic support to keep his government solvent, and diplomatic support. And consequently, a one-on-one is either going to result in an impasse, that is, Putin will demand and Zelensky will say no, and they will part having achieved nothing, or maybe they'll bring Trump into the room. And I think Trump wants to be standing nearby and would love to be called in as the referee. But then again, is Trump predictable? Will Trump side with Ukraine, or will Trump side with Russia, or will he equivocate in a way that again puts the advantage in Russian side. That is, the Russians are advancing on the battlefield slowly, with great cost, but they are advancing, and that without American weapons support, air defense weapons, 155-millimeter artillery shells, HIMARS weapons, and so forth, Ukraine cannot sustain a war of attrition for very much longer. So very much the ability of Putin to steamroller Ukraine, if the United States and Europe don't stand firm behind Ukraine, is very threatening, and that we would all, I think, be discouraged if Putin moved forward and Ukraine had to step back, because Ukraine's security is Europe's security, and Europe's security is our security, even in New Zealand and the Asia Pacific, because China is watching this whole episode. And if Putin succeeds in Ukraine, China may be emboldened then to attack Taiwan and otherwise deny the South China Sea to legitimate commerce. So there are global implications for this that go well beyond just the province of Donetsk and Luhansk and the current battle line. They echo right throughout the global balance of power.
And with Zelensky and a Ukrainian delegation being present, do you think there's a possibility that a hypothetical Putin-Zelensky summit could result in better outcomes for Ukraine?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it's good that they meet. Who can deny the fact that the leaders in the conflict should meet, and maybe they can find a formula or a direction or a talk to begin a talk? But I think we're pretty pessimistic at this point, because Russia has not agreed to a ceasefire. Trump has backed off the notion of a ceasefire. Obviously, he talked to Putin, and in those secret talks, we still don't know the dialogue of. It seems pretty clear that Trump came out second best, and Putin was very firm that no ceasefire. Well, this is to Ukraine's disadvantage, to the extent that the Russian forces are now moving forward slowly, painfully, with great cost, but nevertheless, they seem to have the front foot, and Ukraine seems to be on the back foot at the moment. So a direct summit between the Ukrainian and Russian leaders would certainly be in Russia's favor. They have the larger army. They have a firmer position. They aren't dependent on a Trump to help or harm them the way the Ukrainian side is. So I guess I would, well, I wouldn't recommend against a summit. I would simply counsel the Ukrainian side to, if things are not going well, to walk away from it at some point. Of course, the risk is if Ukraine walks away, then Trump will blame Ukraine for torpedoing the talks, and his Trump's goal of achieving peace and a Nobel Peace Prize. And so poor old Ukraine is in an invidious and unfavorable position vis-a-vis the Russians, caught between the Russians and Trump, and not having total control of the situation.
And that was former professor in politics and international relations at the University of Auckland, Stefan Hoadley, talking about the outcomes of the Trump-Putin summit that happened over the weekend. We'll be back after a quick break. Keep it on the B.
95 BFM.
We'll be right back. Heavy psychedelic synth-driven trio Half Hexagon are releasing their first two EPs on vinyl. EP 1 and EP 2 join forces on one limited edition record. Plus, the album will feature an additional two exclusive unreleased bonus tracks. EP 1 and EP 2 by Half Hexagon. Available on vinyl from Friday, August 22nd, where fine music is sold. Or pre-order now at halfhexagon.bandcamp.com.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The cat's out of the bag.
I look forward to seeing a sausage with a sword tonight.
The can of worms is open.
I reckon a cat with a sword would be pretty diabolical.
Pandora's box has been irreversibly meddled with.
They've already got heaps of little swords in their hands.
Introducing your brand new 95BFM breakfast show hosts, Millie and Rosetta.
I'm a fan.
You are a fan. I love that.
The 95BFM breakfast show. Tune in every weekday morning from 7 till 10 a.m. Only on 95BFM.
Hey, New Zealand artists!
Here's some good news, straight from the horse's mouth.
We know it can be hard out there, so we just made it a whole lot cheaper for artists to advertise on 95BFM.
We've just launched new advertising packages that offer big discounts for Kiwi musicians, theatre makers, filmmakers, dancers, writers, arts orgs,
or anything similar, kind of like that or in between.
Check out all the details on 95BFM.com to see if you qualify, or email the sales team for more info.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. In November 2019, the autonomous region and island of Bougainville held a referendum to decide whether they should express a desire for independence instead of continued autonomy as part of Papua New Guinea. The result of the vote saw a landslide 97.7% majority vote for independence and would see Bougainville seek to replace South Sudan as the newest country in the world. Yet despite this, Bougainville remains an autonomous region of Papua New Guinea 6 years later. This difficult transition period has resulted in political tensions rising between the island and Papua New Guinea. However, the recent signing of the Melanesian Agreement in June is seen by experts as a significant step towards independence for Bougainville. To talk about why the situation has dragged on for so long, and what we can expect moving forward, I spoke to Gordon Nanau, the head of Pacific Studies at the University of Auckland. For those who aren't aware, could you explain why Bougainville has been pushing for independence in the first place?
Okay, I think to go back to the Bougainville crisis as the basis of why these discussions are happening. There was a civil conflict. There's a longer history behind it, but there was a conflict from 1988. It's commonly known as the Bougainville crisis. I think it resulted in, you know, more than 20,000 people killed. And so they, you know, over 10 years or so, there was that conflict. And they initially met in Venom, I think, New Zealand to discuss and agree on a peace deal, which is to stop the fighting and then the beginning of the peace process. So I think this is a continuation of that, and Bougainville wanted to be an independent state from Papua New Guinea even before the crisis. So this is a process where the Bougainvillians are pushing, or they are progressing their wish for a politically independent Bougainville, independent from Papua New Guinea.
And given that independence was voted for by 97% of the region 6 years ago, what has stopped them from seceding from Papua New Guinea?
the 97% that you mentioned was based on the referendum that they carried out, and obviously many or majority of the Bougainvillians wanted independence. But I think there is also the process that, you know, there's a legitimate process that they wish to follow, and I think it's guided by processes in the UN for Bougainville to, you know, to have that autonomy that they've been calling for over the years.
Can you explain what the Melanesian Agreement is and why you think this is a significant step towards independence for Bougainville?
The Melanesian Agreement, as I've said earlier, is a continuation, or it's a step within the peace process, and basically focusing on that referendum, the results of the referendum that you mentioned earlier, the 97%. And I think part of the Melanesian Agreement was to see how best they can take that, you know, that referendum result, which is at the moment non-binding, through the process of parliament, or through the process of the Bougainville Council, I think, to bring that into the discussion. So the process to legitimize that, the outcome of that referendum is important. I think that's the step to recognizing that outcome is an important part of this Melanesian Agreement that you mentioned.
Why is the Bougainville situation important for other regions in the Pacific or around the world?
Yeah, I think it's important in a few fronts, I guess. One is looking at it from the Papua New Guinea side of things, there is the caution that maybe it can potentially lead to other regions in the country interested in becoming independent states. There's that caution that is I think appreciated in the process. But the other important point from where I'm standing is, you know, the importance of groups or islands that probably is similar, they're not related and are being lumped together as a country due to the colonial process. And this is an opportunity for that decolonization process, or that autonomy to be given to those kinds of communities. So there are two positions in that discussion. One is, will this encourage other regions to ask for their own autonomy? And there's also this position that I think it's right for people who regard themselves as one and are different from others who have been, you know, they've been lumped together as a country due to colonial processes, to be given the autonomy. But I think these are very simple things that I'm mentioning. They're more complicated than what I've just said.
And looking ahead, just because Bougainville's separation from, or independence from, Papua New Guinea hasn't been too smooth, do you think other nation states or autonomous regions also wanting independence will take confidence from the situation, or will they have become more skeptical?
The case of Bougainville is different, or is peculiar, in the sense that a lot of lives, a lot of properties were destroyed in that process, and it has been that call for independence, that call for autonomy has been ongoing since even before 1975, when they got that independence from Australia. So in that context, maybe it may make others struggle a bit more if they're calling for similar kind of autonomy, because they may not be well established or well recognized, or it's probably not a historical process as was the case in Bougainville. And as I've said, I think the Bougainvillians went through a lot, especially the civil crisis, the Bougainville crisis that resulted in many lives lost. I think that made that situation, the Bougainville situation, different from maybe other calls for autonomy in PNG.
And what possible outcomes do you see for Bougainville in the next few years?
Yeah, I think that's up for Bougainville and Papua New Guinea to agree on. But I think from understanding the history, looking at the history of the Bougainville crisis up until now, I think they will be pushing for independence, and I think they would be pushing for an independent Bougainville, but maybe while maintaining their historical and very close relationship with Papua New Guinea and, of course, the neighbouring Solomon Islands next door.
And that was Gordon Nanau on the situation in Bougainville and what we should expect moving forward. We'll be right back after this short break.
95 BFM.
We'll be right back.
children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Wherever you're listening to this, it's quite unlikely that you arrived at that location by walking there. How do I know this? Because according to a 2018 census, 82.8% of trips made in Auckland were by car. And that's despite most New Zealanders understanding that walking has many benefits. It keeps us healthy, reduces stress, and produces zero carbon emissions. So why don't we walk more? Well, Dr. Yi-Ting Chuang, a senior lecturer at the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, conducted a study to look into why people in Auckland and Hamilton are so dependent on cars, despite many areas fitting the conditions of an ideal walking location. I spoke to Yi-Ting Chuang to understand what her research found about our dependence on cars and what we could do to build a walking culture.
I think a lot of us understand the many benefits there are to walking. Can you explain why most of us still choose to drive anyway?
I think in our census in 2018, it's a high number of percentage trips in Auckland that was by car, and we have a very minimal trips that's actually taken by walk. And Auckland Transport also did a research survey on people why we love car, like Kiwi love car so much. And the number one reason was that our city was designed for cars. And that actually sort of gets us into the mindset that we don't really have a choice, but we have to go everywhere by car, and it sort of becomes a common consensus. And that sort of started our research query to look into whether really our urban structure was a barrier for walking or not.
And do you think that this is a major issue that New Zealand should solve?
Definitely, because we know that how much benefit walking actually brings to our health and also the environment as well. Especially in New Zealand, we do have a lot of short trips that was taken up by car, and the carbon emission that emitted from the cars are actually making a huge detrimental effect in our environment. So if we can just sort of convert that, we'll make a lot of positive benefit to our environment.
Can you explain what the 15-minute city ideal is and how that factored into your research?
Definitely. So 15-minute city is a planning concept that was based on the sustainability ideal. Having evenly distributed our essential services, for example, our daily needs, supermarket, parks, school, workplaces, and clinics within a walking distance, 15 minutes of walking or cycling distance, which would then replace our short car trips that we would need to take. So it's actually a sustainable planning concept that has been taking up a lot of traction in Europe cities as well as in a lot of other cities as well. And there was a conspiracy earlier on about how during COVID, that 15-minute city is actually trying to restrict people's mobility to confine them within a distance. But I think that's a conspiracy.
How come in the case of Auckland and Hamilton, proximity and the 15-minute city rule doesn't necessarily translate into more walking?
Yeah, that was quite a surprise result that we found. We mapped all the essential services within 15-minute walking distance of a few neighborhoods in Auckland and Hamilton, and we actually found that a lot of areas actually meet that ideal. So you are able to walk to, but people don't really know. But I also feel like, of course, 15-minute is an arbitrary number, and it doesn't really always sort of meets everybody's need, and in Auckland particularly there is the terrain, the slopey terrain, so it feels longer to walk to places that probably is actually needed to. And also I think people don't have the information of how long it takes really to connect to the places that you have to go to.
Is that a recent trend, or has that problem existed for a long time in Auckland and Hamilton?
Oh, I think it's a long time sort of problem that existed. And also it's the mentality in sort of New Zealand, or car dependent city, that we really don't think of another alternative to walk to. And it has been really, the city are built to prioritize car, I would have to say, even though it's still meets the 15-minute city ideal, but it's still prioritized and it's very convenient to drive everywhere. And parking was amply provided everywhere, and that's why, you know, it's the number one choice and the easiest choice, but not necessarily the best choice.
In your research, you mentioned three key attributes to walking behavior: street network continuity, access to destinations, and the walking experience itself. Which of these do you think we should focus on to improve walking in New Zealand?
And like I said in the research, our finding actually is very context specific. These three elements are interconnected and they are all really important, but their priority of importance is related to the context. For example, we found that walking trips happens more in underserved neighborhoods, and we are hypothesizing that because these trips are taken up because people have to walk, they might not have cars to go everywhere. So if those are functional basic needs, then we really need to prioritize connecting the places they need to go to safely and continuously, and because they are underserved, which means that these areas often have less appropriate sidewalks to connect to everywhere, and that would become the priority. But for other neighborhoods, for example, a more well sort of served communities, we've discovered that their walking trips are often happened in working hours, and we're hypothesizing they would be probably more discretionary walking, like leisure walking. And those walks, and especially in a better environment already, what they really need is the experiences to make the trip comfortable. So people would want to walk rather than they have to walk. So the priorities are quite different depending on the neighborhood, as well as the motivations or purposes of the walks. So it will have to be sort of context specific, and which is the beauty of the research, that we know that there's no one answer to solve all questions and problems.
What kinds of design changes can be made to areas that can increase walking without needing major overhauls?
Again, I think it's depending on where they are, but I think the priority should be putting in the underserved area, because that's where we found most walking trips are happening already. And like I said, it's a needed basis. So having the sidewalk well lit, continuous, and also maybe sufficient, wide enough to help people get to the places that they need to get to. And I guess it's also, we need to bring that extra, once we have the basic needs met, we need that extra flair. So the pleasures that you would actually encourage and invite people to want to walk. And we do want to build a walking culture, because it's almost like a chicken and egg thing. If people wanted to walk more and more people are walking, the city would slowly be shaped, and the politicians might be, you know, thinking, okay, we should rebalance the roadway spaces as well. So more people wanted to do it, the city would slowly change or shaped by the need of the people, and the resources can be delegated to the more important things as well.
And that was Dr. Yi-Ting Chuang from the University of Auckland on her research into foot traffic in Auckland and Hamilton and what New Zealand should do to build a walking culture.
That was The Wire.
Ko I rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Big thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Gordon Nanao from the University of Auckland, Dr. Yi-Ting Chuang from the University of Auckland, and Stephen Hoadley, formerly from the School of Social Sciences at the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning into 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.